Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings to all of you from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets. My not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad to be back with you once again. And I am just thrilled to be able to tell you about our program tonight. In the second 2 hours, I'll be joined by Lon Strickler, a fellow traveler on the investigatory road that leads to strange topics, the kind that we sink our teeth into on this program week after week. Lon is what you might call a voice of reason in this realm of unusual subject matter, a believer in science and rationalism, but who keeps an open mind about just how mysterious and wondrous our world can be. But first, coming up in just a few minutes, a guest I've been trying to interview on this program for a couple of years now. If you like to read about science, high tech, robotics, the future, then you'll know his name, Ray Kurzweil, a brilliant man, inventor, entrepreneur, author. He's got more patents than I've got shirts, and he's someone who sees a long way down the road. In many ways, he's not only helping us to understand what's coming our way, he's actually playing a major role in shaping our collective future, a world that is both frightening and exhilarating in its possibilities. About 30, 32 years from now, Ray thinks that humanity will reach a point known as the singularity, when we will essentially become immortal, largely because we will merge with machines, with computers, the next logical step in our evolution as a species as he sees it. And that's about as big and bold a prediction as it gets, but it's much more than just like a plot for a new sci-fi movie. This transformation, he says, is already underway. And if you look around, I think you might agree with him. Ray Kurzweil has written a new book, How to Create a Mind. And it's a mind bender, a roadmap of sorts for how future scientists will be able to build bigger, better brains, how they would be capable of downloading our memories, our experiences, the essence of who we are into machines, which of course raises all sorts of mind-numbing questions about the nature of life, of consciousness, what it is that makes us human. Can we become immortal? And if so, should we become immortal? Big ideas, huge questions, meaty subjects for us to sink our teeth into, and I can't wait to get started. Webmaster Tim Bidall and I have put together our usual assortment of hand-picked news stories and oddities, including a few that directly relate to our interviews tonight. I invite you to take a look at them on the Coast to Coast website when you have a couple of minutes in the NAPS news section. And we might talk about a few of them later in this program, but enough setting the table. Let's get right to it. We take our first break and return with the man often described as a flat-out genius, Ray Kurzweil. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Knapp. But 2 years ago this month, Time magazine ran a cover story with this attention-grabbing headline. It read, 2045, the year man becomes immortal, which focused largely on the amazing career and theories of author, inventor, futurist Ray Kurzweil, who recently took on a new title, Director of Engineering at Google. He was described by the Wall Street Journal as a restless genius, and by others as the, quote, rightful heir to Thomas Edison. He's the recipient of our nation's highest honor in technology, the National Medal of Technology, awarded by the president. He's been amazing the rest of us since he was a teenager, has made astounding leaps in computer technology and music, written several national bestsellers, including The Singularity is Near, and his newest work, the focus of tonight's discussion, a very important book, How to Create a Mind. I'm thrilled to welcome you back to the Coast to Coast show, Ray.
Great to be with you again, George. Thanks for that generous introduction.
Well, I'm thrilled about it. I mean, I've been reading about you and reading your stuff for a long time, and it's made an impression on me. I want to jump right into the deep end of the pool. We'll get into what the singularity might mean for all of us listening during the next 2 hours, but I'd like to start with your take on its inevitability. Your new book focuses a great deal on the pace of change, this exponential growth in technology and computing power, and I look around at the pace of technological change, and you see it all around us daily, weekly. And like a lot of people, it feels like I'm sort of locked in a hot rod, you know, speeding down a steep hill. The doors are locked, the gas pedal's floored, and it's stuck. And all I can do is go along for the ride. And there's no stop in this vehicle. And is that way the way you see it? Short of like an asteroid slamming into Earth or nuclear war, the things that you describe in this book as being in our future sound pretty much inevitable, whether we like it or not.
Well, the pace of change is indeed accelerating. It took hundreds of thousands of years for our first invention, spoken language, only 10,000 years for written language, 400 years for the printing press to reach a mass audience. The telephone reached a quarter of the U.S. population in 50 years. The cell phone did that in 7 years. Social networks, wikis, blogs did that in 3 years. So change is happening faster and faster. And what is driving this, and one of my primary theses, is that the power of information technology, its price performance, its capacity, doubles about every year. So that's a 1,000-fold increase in 10 years, a 1,000,000-fold improvement in 20 years. That's what we've seen. You know, the computer in my cell phone is several billion times more powerful per dollar than the computer I used when I was a student. We'll do that again in the next 25 years. And we're shrinking technology. That computer is 100,000 times smaller. We'll do that again. These kinds of computers will be the size of blood cells in about 25 years. Gives you some idea of what will be feasible.
And you can understand why people would be scared about it. I mean, people of my age and older, they see things changing so much. It just seems overwhelming.
Well, you know, we're going to see very profound change very quickly. So even baby boomers like myself, I just turned 65 a couple of weeks ago, you know, should be in good shape when we get to a point where we're going to be adding more than a year every year to your remaining life expectancy, which is not a guarantee of immortality, but it's a tipping point in terms of longevity. So that's only 15 years from now. And we're making great gains now that health and medicine has actually become an information technology. So it's now subject to what I call the law of accelerating returns, this exponential growth that didn't used to be true of health and medicine. It was basically hit or miss. They were still useful. Life expectancy was 20 1,000 years ago. It was actually 37 in 1800, only 200 years ago, 48 in 1900. It's now pushing 80, but this will go into high gear when we get into the sort of mature phase of what we call the biotechnology revolution.
You mentioned the law of accelerating returns, and of course it's an important point that you cover in the book, How to Create a Mind. Tell me why at some point the acceleration doesn't become so advanced that no one, I mean, not even a guy like you, can guess where it leads. I read an interview you did with the Hollywood Reporter about movies, and you talked about sci-fi movies in the future, and they'll get one little point right, but they really basically are just describing the same society. But there must be some sort of a tipping point where suddenly the pace of change in all aspects of life are so fast and so numerous that even a guy like you can't imagine where it leads.
Well, the problem with movies is it takes a lot of cinematic time to explain a change in the future. So a lot of these movies about the future show you one change on an otherwise unchanged world. So, you know, AI had human-level cyborgs, but the coffee maker was the same and the cars were the same and nothing else had changed. Many aspects of our lives are going to change. We're going to be increasingly inhabiting virtual reality environments. We'll be blending real reality and augmented reality. We're going to be extending our lives and our health with turning health and medicine into an information technology. We'll have machines that gain human levels of intelligence, but we're going to use them to make ourselves smarter and ultimately merge with them. I mean, even our cell phones today are really an extension of our minds, even though it's not inside our bodies and brains, but there are people who have computers connected into their brains, like Parkinson's patients or deaf patients who have cochlear implants. It's actually a new experimental retinal implant for the blind. This will become routine when we can introduce these computerized devices non-invasively without surgery. When they become the size of blood cells, we can just send them in through the bloodstream. That's a 2030s scenario. So we're going to use this future artificial intelligence to actually make ourselves smarter. And we are already, in my view, smarter than we used to be. I've managed work groups for 40 years, and today, you know, I can have a group of three or four people do in a few weeks what used to require groups of hundreds of people several years. We're definitely more productive and basically smarter than we used to be because of these brain extenders. And they're going to continue to get smarter in terms of software and hardware and smaller, giving us the opportunity to integrate with them more fluidly. And we're one of the exponential trends is we're learning more and more about the brain. Our ability, in fact, to look inside the brain is expanding exponentially. We can now actually see individual neuronal interconnections firing in real time and forming in real time, and we can actually look inside a living brain and see that brain create your thoughts, but also see your thoughts create your brain. That's part of the secret of human thought, is that this grand hierarchy that represents our neocortex, where we do our thinking, we actually create that all those connections with our own thoughts from the moment we're born or even earlier. So we really, not only are we what we eat, but we very much are what we think. Our own thoughts create our brain. And I describe actually how that works in the book.
I read an interview where you said that you had basically been thinking about this book, this topic, the human brain, for 50 years. You always sort of figured in the back of your mind you're going to write a book to explain how the brain works. But did you sort of have to wait for science to catch up with where you wanted to go? A lot of the developments you and discoveries that you describe in the book are really new, last 3-4 years.
Well, it's literally true. I wrote a paper 50 years ago, actually, when I was 14. It was my Westinghouse Science Talent Search submission describing how I thought the brain worked. And I described it as a large group of pattern recognizers. So basically what the brain is good at is recognizing patterns. We don't do a very good job of logical thinking. Computers are much better at that than we are, but we're very good at recognizing patterns. And I basically say the same thing now in this book, 50 years later. That paper I wrote 50 years ago got me to meet President Johnson, and I developed a system that could write original music based on these theories, and 50 years ago took that on national TV. I described essentially the same thesis, that the brain is made up of a large number of pattern recognizers, actually 300 million of them. That's my estimate that I derive in the book. And that's how the neocortex works. It recognizes a lot of patterns. The neocortex, which comprises about 80% of our brain, is the part of our brain where we do our thinking. And we think in hierarchies. We recognize patterns in a grand hierarchy. So at the very lowest part of the hierarchy, we recognize very simple things like the crossbar in a capital A or the edge of an object or very simple sounds. At the high conceptual end of this hierarchy, we recognize patterns like irony or humor or beauty. And those recognizers that recognize these abstract features are actually no more complicated than the ones that recognize very simple features. They just exist at this highest level of the conceptual hierarchy. And this hierarchy is actually formed by actual connections, actual axons and dendrites between these different modules in the neocortex. Each module is made up of about 100 neurons. We have about 300 million of these modules. Each module recognizes a pattern. And that hierarchy we create with our own thoughts, and we create one conceptual level at a time. So I have a 16-month-old grandson, and he has successfully laid down, you know, several levels of this hierarchy. As adults, we've, you know, mastered many more levels, and we continue to learn throughout our lives. We actually fill up those 300 million recognizers by the time we're about 20. So then to learn new material, we have to forget something that's old, and some people are better at that than others. But I describe exactly how that process works in the book, and we can use these insights and models and methods and algorithms that we've derived from how human thinking works to actually build intelligent machines, and that's what I'm going to be doing actually at Google.
Well, you made me feel a little bit better in the book, in that I thought it was just me and Homer Simpson who had just pointy little heads that could only take so much stuff, and we had to learn a lot of new stuff. We had to get rid of some old stuff. But as you just mentioned, that may not I might not be alone in that regard. Last week, the New York Times reported that President Obama is going to launch this 10-year mapping of the brain, a massive project. They're talking about maybe $3 billion worth of research. Amazing that anyone would even pitch the idea at a time like this, when our country can't seem to afford a new pair of shoes, and so many of us oppose spending of any kind. Did your book give this plan a little kick in the butt, or do you think it was already in the works? And what might it mean for the topics and possibilities that you cover?
Well, it's hard to say what influenced it, but it's a very good decision, because if you think about it, what's more important than intelligence? I mean, intelligence has enabled humans to, you know, reshape the planet. The fact that our life expectancy today is almost 80 rather than 20, which is what it was 1,000 years ago, is because of our intelligence, our ability to overcome human suffering, or to create music and art, literature and science, technology, products that you use every day, like your cell phone. That all comes from intelligence. If we have more intelligence, we'll be able to, you know, do a better job of meeting the grand challenges of humanity. And in fact, it's only by expanding our intelligence that we'll be able to meet these grand challenges. And we will literally expand our intelligence by learning how human intelligence works, creating machines, you know, in our own image, basically using the same methods, and then merging with that technology to make ourselves smarter. And the whole idea of the singularity is that we will, you know, vastly expand our own intelligence. And the reason we call it a singularity is we borrow this metaphor from physics, that there's an event horizon around a singularity that's hard to see beyond. But we actually have enough intelligence today to, you know, imagine what life will be like. And so that's what I talk about in my book, Singularities Near, and in this new book, How to Create a Mind.
I read a figure that was tossed out in discussing this proposed study of the brain, that every dollar that was put into studying the human genome returned $140 to the national economy in one way or another. And I wonder if there's any kind of comparable statistic for what the mapping of the human brain might pay off, if there are practical ways that you could sell the idea this is a good study to embark on.
Well, they're related, because, you know, the whole field of biology on which health and medicine is based on has become an information technology enabled by the Genome Project. The Genome Project gave us the software of life, and that was completed in 2003. That was an exponential progression. We doubled the amount of genetic sequencing we did each year. So halfway through that project, only 1% had been done, and skeptics considered it a failure. But, you know, 1% is only 7 doublings from 100%, and 7 years later, the project was done. We now have the means of actually reprogramming the outdated software that runs in our bodies. We can turn genes off. We can add new genes. We can reprogram stem cells to regrow every organ in our bodies. And as a result, health and medicine, rather than progressing linearly, which is what it has done, you know, in recent decades, is going to expand at an exponential pace. Now, our brains are biological also, and it's really part of this process of understanding biology as information. And so studying the human brain is really, you know, related to the Genome Project. It's, in fact, a lot of the human brain is governed by genes, and there's a link to genes and brain structures, and that's going to be part of what's going to be studied. But understanding our brains will give us the templates and the designs to create more intelligent machines to, in turn, make our own brains smarter.
Do you get grief from biologists who say, who is this guy to write about something as complex as a human brain?
Well, yes. I mean, there is a common idea in neuroscience that, oh, the brain is so complex, we could never understand it, and our brains are inherently not powerful enough to understand our brains. And, for example, I describe in the book how Paul Allen describes every single connection, all of the hundreds of trillions of them, has been placed precisely the way it is based on, you know, biological evolution. We need to understand every one of these hundreds of trillions of connections in order to understand the human brain. What he's ignoring is that there's a tremendous amount of repetition and redundancy. I mentioned 300 million panel recognizers. They're all very similar. If you understand one, you'll understand pretty much all 300 million. And there's a basic mechanism how they wire themselves to each other based on our own experience. And you don't have to understand that 300 million times over. You can understand it once. So the amount of complexity in the brain, it's manageable for us to understand. It's not simple, but I describe the basic method in the book.
Ray Kurzweil, I'm going to have to.
Just come out in recent months, really.
And we'll get into that after this break. We will ask Ray Kurzweil about the relationship he had with Stevie Wonder. He invented something that, at Stevie Wonder's request, and it changed the face of music. There are good developments from technological advances, and there are scary developments, of course. We've all seen the movies about Skynet and Terminators and things of that sort. We'll ask Ray Kurzweil about the dark side of technology and what we have to worry about in the future right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Ray, I mentioned during the break the Stevie Wonder story that I might ask you about what you developed that helped him and changed music forever. Can you tell that in a nutshell?
Sure. My main interest, as I mentioned, is panel recognition, and I came up with a way of recognizing printed letters. I sat next to a blind guy in a plane, and he explained that the biggest problem he had was inability to read ordinary print. So I developed that technology into a reading machine for the blind, which included the first flatbed scanner and character recognition and speech synthesis. And I demonstrated it on the Today Show, and Stevie Wonder happened to catch that, and he actually dropped over to our office and took our first production model, the Kurzweil reading machine. This was 1976. And that started a friendship, which has lasted to this day. And we used to talk about technology, and he had, over the years, and acquired many Kurzweil reading machines. And in 1982, he's giving me a tour of his new music studio, Wonderland, he called it. And he was lamenting the state of affairs in musical instruments. So with these beautiful 19th century instruments like pianos, guitars, violins that made beautiful sounds, but they're very hard to play, and you couldn't play them from memory. You couldn't, most of them, you can't even play more than one note at a time, like a violin. Then there was this world of computer-generated music where you could play something and the computer would remember it and play it back, and you could play another line over it. You could change the sounds, like editing notes, like editing words on a word processor. But the sounds you had to work with were very thin and not satisfying, didn't have the richness of these acoustic instruments. So I said, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could combine these two worlds of music? So I said I thought that would be possible using panel recognition and signal processing, and asked him if he would work with me as our musical advisor, and we created Kurzweil Music Systems in 1982. And in 1983, we demonstrated the Kurzweil 250, which has been recognized as the first computerized musical instrument that could accurately recreate the piano and other orchestral instruments. And Stevie Wonder actually played and composed that song you played using the Kurzweil synthesizer. And he has probably 40 or 50 of them now. And I've kept up the relationship with him for several decades now.
That's awesome. That's an awesome story. You know, I've read a lot of interviews with you where you are kind of careful. You don't tip your hand when you're describing technological change, the pace of change, good or bad. I mean, you said something about fire. Yes, fire is good. It keeps us warm. It cooks our food. It also can burn down our home and our village. Recognizing there's good and bad in all kinds of technology. But I think at the end of this book, you do tip your hand in describing that we are better off as a species and a planet because of the changes the last 50 years or so.
Well, yeah, I mean, technology is a double-edged sword, but there's no question that human life has improved immeasurably. I mentioned that human life expectancy has doubled just in 200 years, and it's going to go into high gear very soon. Life was incredibly difficult. Some people think, oh, life was great before technology, and until technology came along, we didn't have, you know, significant problems. You know, I invite people to read Thomas Hobbes, how brutal life was a few hundred years ago. He described it as disaster-prone, poverty-filled, short, brutish, and filled with illness and so on, or read Charles Dickens. Life was very, very difficult. This new book by Steven Pinker, where he shows there's a very dramatic decline and steady decline in violence over the centuries. You actually had a 300 times greater chance to be killed violently a few hundred years ago than you do today, because those were eras of extreme scarcity. There was just not enough food and other resources to go around, and people settled disputes violently. We're far wealthier. I mean, Social Security was not put in place until 1930. Why was that? Because people weren't liberal enough until that time? There just wasn't the economic resources to provide a social safety net until, you know, fairly recently in human history. So we are wealthier, we're healthier than we ever were. These new technologies are going to, you know, really have an opportunity to overcome the grand challenges of humanity. Take energy. People think we're running out of energy. We actually have 10,000 times more energy than we need coming from the sun every day. We only have to capture one part in 10,000 to meet all of our energy needs. And the total amount of solar energy is on an exponential increase. It's doubling every 2 years. And it's now less than seven doublings for meeting 100% of our energy needs. So, you know, well within 2 decades, we could meet all of our energy needs with this very inexpensive renewable form. There's other revolutions coming in clean water, food production, inexpensive housing, three-dimensional printing, where we can print out three-dimensional objects at very, very low cost from inexpensive materials, from information files. I can, in fact, today email you a violin or a guitar, and you can actually print out, you know, very high-quality instruments using your three-dimensional printer. And within a decade, you know, you'll be able to use your three-dimensional printer to print out another three-dimensional printer. So then the three-dimensional printers can expand exponentially, and ultimately everybody in the world can have one at very low cost.
And yet it's scary, though. I mean, the stuff that you describe in this book, downloading my brain.
There are dangers. I mean, there's subtle ones. You know, people are concerned about things like privacy and protection of intellectual property. And then there are existential ones. Take biotechnology, which we talked about earlier, the ability to reprogram biology away from disease and away from aging, you know, good things. But the same technology could be used by a bioterrorist in a routine college bioengineering lab, you know, near you or near me, and reprogram a biological virus to be more deadly or more communicable or more stealthy and create a super weapon. Now, we're not defenseless against these things. I've actually worked with the Army on a rapid response system to protect us from a new deadly biological virus. But it's not these are not pat solutions. We have to keep, you know, reinventing ways to protect ourselves. There definitely are dangers. I mean, look at the 20th century. We invented atomic weapons, and, you know, we have enough atomic weapons to wipe out all of humanity or all of mammalian life. So, I mean, these are profound existential downsides. Nonetheless, the benefits to humanity have far outweighed the dangers. You know, if you just look at actual measures of health, wealth, education, and other basic measures of human well-being.
It's hard to tackle this question, though. You do a good job in dealing with it in the book. And I have to say, what I like most about the new book is that this is weighty, serious scientific stuff, but it's written for a general audience and people like myself, non-scientists who want to know what the future might hold. It's easy to follow. But these questions are profound. I mean, I like being a human. And while I would like to have my brain augmented by a computer, I guess to some extent it already is, maybe I'd like to be as strong as Iron Man or something, I still want to be human and biological and not mechanical. And the idea that I become a machine is frightening to me.
Well, you said you'd like to remain human. There's a question as to what that means.
What is it? Right.
I would draw a distinction between being human and being biological. I mean, we're going to augment our biology. And really, the whole history of technology is for us to transcend the limitations of biology. I mean, 1,000 years ago, we couldn't reach, you know, the fruit hanging from a higher branch. So we invented a tool that extended our reach and enabled us to reach that higher branch. And we've been extending our reach physically and mentally ever since. We, you know, we've vastly extended our reach and overcome, you know, many types of limitations with our machines, you know, particularly computers, but all kinds of machines. And that's going to continue to happen. And it really overcomes our limitations. It overcomes human suffering. So the fact that we use machines, and even if we get very close to them, and even if we put them inside ourselves, which is already happening, it doesn't make us not human. I've talked to, for example, Parkinson's patients who have a computer in their body connected into their brain, and I ask them, you know, does that make you less human? And they invariably say no. And most of them will say that computer that's inside them is really part of themselves, and they're actually very proud of it because it, you know, restored some, you know, human function that they had before and that they lost. And they're perfectly happy to have it replaced by a computer.
Well, I look at some young people with their cell phones that are might as well be permanently attached to their ears because they never put them down. And I guess, you know, we all use computers to extend our own intelligence and our abilities now. But at some point, it seems like if I were a sci-fi writer and I read your book and looked at the future scenarios that you describe, I would imagine I'd start writing the screenplay now in which bands of remaining humans hide out in the wilderness, hanging on to their biological bodies as everyone around that becomes part machine.
Well, I mean, that is a sort of common plot line, but
yeah,
I think actually very, very few people will opt out. I mean, who opts out now from, you know, using electronic technology? You know, maybe the Amish. People say, oh, there'll be a conflict, a war between those who enhance themselves with technology and those who choose to, you know, remain pure and human. And I've pointed out, well, that would be a short war, kind of like a war between our military today and the Amish. But very few people opt out. I mean, and it's not going to be one thing. You're not going to get a form check here. I want to be enhanced, yes or no. I mean, there's going to be millions of choices. There's a million choices today just of apps for your Google phone or your iPhone. And the same thing will be true when we put the computers inside us. There'll be very conservative technologies, which you'd be irresponsible not to use because they've been proven to, you know, eliminate and overcome cancer and other diseases. And they're very well proven and conservative. There'll be, you know, more cutting edge technologies that are only early adopters will use. So it's not going to be one thing, and very few people will opt out completely. You know, you don't have to look far to see people who are suffering terribly from all kinds of, you know, diseases, physical and mental ailments, and the opportunity to overcome these limitations is really a great opportunity. And whenever, you know, these kinds of developments come, if there's a better treatment for cancer or any disease, it's celebrated. So, you know, people think it's controversial in the abstract when you talk about the sort of accumulated effect of all these changes. It may sound scary, but we don't sort of make one leap to the future. It occurs in thousands of little steps. And each step, a better treatment for heart disease or a better way to, you know, search the internet is celebrated. Because it has benefits, and, you know, it has to go in the marketplace, and the ones that really are beneficial, win out.
I guess that answers sort of my next question, which I was going to get into: who gets the benefits? Let's say, you know, the year comes, singularity's here, we can merge into something else. But, you know, the gap between rich and poor now is so wide and getting wider, and there are some amazing medical technologies that have been developed that are not available to regular people because they can't afford them.
I would take issue with that. I mean, one of the implications of the law of accelerating returns is a 50% deflation rate. So you can buy, you know, an Android phone or an iPhone that's twice as good today for half the price as one 2 years ago. That's a quadrupling of price performance in 2 years. It's a 50% deflation rate per year. So people say, oh, only the wealthy will have these technologies. And I say, yeah, like cell phones, of which there are 6 billion in the world today. There's one for every person on the planet. There's about 1 billion smartphones. And they're very democratizing, powerful technologies. A kid in Africa with a smartphone, which is a common occurrence, has access to more intelligent knowledge than the president of the United States did 15 years ago. And these are very democratizing tools. You know, a kid in college created Facebook on his $1,000 notebook. A couple of kids at Stanford created Google on their $1,000 notebooks. And we have teenagers today doing remarkable things with very inexpensive but powerful tools. So they're really in everybody's hands. They're getting less and less expensive. People are developing computers today that will cost $20 or $30 to provide them to people in the, you know, emerging economies. I really think these technologies will be very widespread. It's really only the wealthy can afford these technologies at a point where they really don't work very well. You know, like for example, mobile phones 20 years ago, which were the size and weight of a brick, worked very poorly and only did one thing. And today, when you know they run a million different apps, do a very good job of phone calls, they're extremely inexpensive. And as I said, there's 6 or 7 billion of them in the world. And it's going to be the same thing with these future technologies that enable, that increase our intelligence, that improve our health. By the time they work well, they're very, very ubiquitous and inexpensive.
Well, as I was reading your book, I was trying to come up with some points to raise why this was a scary scenario. And I realized, though, that the first guy who really, truly integrates his own brain with a computer has such a competitive advantage against everybody else in the business world or in competitive situations. There's no going back from that. There's already no going
right.
back from
it. And it's also not going to happen in one step. You know, when technologies first come out, like, for example, the ability to talk to your phone, you can do that with Google Now, you can do that with Siri. And when these technologies first emerged, you know, they had limitations, they didn't work very well. So when the technology first appears, people say, it's not a big deal because it really doesn't work very well. Then if, you know, 3 or 4 years later, when it really does work well, people say, it's not a big deal, it's been around for years. So these technologies creep up on us. We're not going to have technologies that, you know, vastly multiply our intelligence instantly. It's going to come in stages. And, you know, by the time they work well, they'll be very inexpensive and very ubiquitous. And, you know, the basic concept will have been around for many years. We get from here to there through thousands of little steps. And each step has to be, you know, proven in the marketplace and accepted. And if there are problems or it doesn't work, then there are people who will reject it. So it's not one leap. I mean, very often science fiction is based on that. There's some new technology that's extremely radical that enables people to multiply their intelligence by a million and, you know, a few people get access to it. But that's not actually how it works.
I know we're going to take a break here in a minute or so, but you know, the sci-fi scenario that has been explored many times, cyborgs, computers, when they become self-aware, like Skynet, why not Skynet? Why not Terminators? What would they need us for at some point when they become self-aware if we can make a distinction between them and us?
Well, I don't think there's going to be a clear distinction between humans and machines. You're not going to be able to walk in a room and say, okay, humans on the left, machines on the right. It's going to be all mixed up. You know, biological humans are going to be vastly enhanced with computers inside them. Computers that perhaps have no biological aspect to them will be derived from humans and based on humans and be integrated with human intelligence in various ways. We are already a human-machine civilization. These machines are not sort of an alien invasion from Mars. I mean, we created these tools and are creating them to extend our own reach and to overcome our own limitations. They're part of who we are. If you ask, well, what does it mean to be human? In my opinion, it's not to be biological. It's, in fact, to be the species that constantly changes who we are and changes ourselves and creates tools to make ourselves smarter.
Well, I definitely want to explore that, what it means to be human, the concept of the soul, where our humanness is. It is our brain or somewhere else. I want to ask you also about your new job with Google and about some of the predictions you've made, which have been uncannily accurate. Much more to come with my guest, Ray Kurzweil, talking about his new book, How to Create a Mind.